Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 73rd Presidential Address of the Society of American Archivists. Please be seated. Please welcome Dana Bell Russell of the Library of Congress.
Good afternoon. As you heard, my name is Dana Bell Russell, and in addition to being an employee of the Library of Congress, I am honored to currently serve as the chair of the Mid-Atlantic Regional Archives Conference, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker. I'm not sure how many people would ask the person that they defeated in an election to introduce them. But such is the relationship that I have with Frank Bowles that when he asked me, I said, sure, so long as I was allowed to knit during his speech. He said, sure, as long as I promised not to poke him with his needles. And he was very happy that I did not bring the surgical steel ones. Frank has been a dear friend for many years. We spent lots of time talking about issues of important to us and important to the archives community. In fact, during a recent visit to D.C., when I went to drop Frank off at the airport, we were so engrossed in our conversation that we couldn't stop, and he and I spent the next 2 hours sitting in the cell phone lot at National Airport talking about some of the issues he was facing as the president of the society and with the profession as a whole. We talked each other into running for president for SAA, but privately, you should know I knew I wasn't going to win. Why, you may ask? Because I had seen Frank's vita with his extensive experience, including his current position as the director of the Clark Historical Library at Central Michigan University. Because I knew of his extensive publications, including selecting and appraising archives and manuscripts, and the seminal article he wrote with Julia Marks Young, Exploring the Black Box, the Appraisal of University Records. I knew that he had extensive professional activities, including a term as chair of the Midwest Archives Conference. But most importantly, I know that he follows Mark Green everywhere. And Mark had served as chair of MAC. Then Frank served as chair of MAC, so I knew it was preordained that if Mark became chair of SAA, Frank had to follow. When I found out that Frank had won, I was a bit sad, but I was okay. When he called me to console me, the first words out of his mouth were, demand a recount and resort to bribery if need be. I smiled, knowing that SAA would be in excellent hands. A few months later, I was in San Francisco for the conference. As many of you may remember, my mom came out with me to celebrate me being named a fellow of the society. On the last day of the conference, my mom had the opportunity to meet the man who beat my daughter in the election. And we had a great time chatting. After Frank left, my mom told me I would have voted for him too. It is with great pleasure that I introduce the mother approved 64th president of the Society of American Archivists, my good friend Frank Bowles.
We're going to switch mics here. Thank you, Dana. Is the banner still standing? Cool. This is going to go a lot better than yesterday. Thank you, Dana. I can't believe your mother said that. And good afternoon to all of you. Let me begin my remarks by thanking each of you for giving me the privilege of serving as president of our society. There's no better place to learn about our profession and the people who populate it than by serving in the position that you have given me for the last year. I am very, very thankful to all of you for that opportunity. I'm also thankful to the SAA members who, with me over the past year, have led the organization, SAA's other elected officers, its council members, and the large number of individuals who serve in volunteer posts throughout the society, all give of themselves with extraordinary generosity and with extraordinary effect. And I am extraordinarily grateful to each of you who has chosen to serve SAA in some capacity. I'm also extraordinarily grateful to the SAA staff. Quite candidly, I think it's very hard to convey just how talented and how dedicated they are. They truly deserve my praise, and they truly do deserve your thanks. And like my predecessors, I'm particularly grateful for the help and support of SAA's Executive Director, Nancy Beaumont, someone I've communicated with one way or another pretty much every day for the last year. Yes, she does work Saturdays and Sundays. The society is a vastly better place for the contribution she makes to our collective welfare, and my presidency was vastly improved by the contribution she made to it. Thank you, Nancy. Let me begin my formal remarks today by explaining that what I will share with you is not the speech I had originally intended to give. Like all those who preceded me on this podium, I dedicated considerable time to writing my remarks. And I'm going to flatter myself by thinking what I had written hit some good points, some good jokes, and included a few cheap shots you can only get away with if you're president of SAA. However, much like the columns I've written for Archival Outlook, while I set out to write one thing, circumstances intervened and led me to write something very, very different. Similarly today, circumstances changed what I wanted to share with you. In all our lives, there comes moments that cause one to pause and reflect about whether or not, in the grand scheme of things, what one does makes any difference. Recently, my family experienced such a moment. Because of it, I put aside what I'd been working on and rather quickly wrote something very different. We'll see if it was too quick in a few moments. You may decide you really should have elected Dana. And I will foreshadow my closing words by simply saying that when you consider the role of archivists in society, all of us in this room are fortunate to have a career that does make a difference. And that difference, in the grand scheme of things, is profound. I've spent a career as a person trained in history, working in archives. I've been fortunate enough to write and speak on the subject, and I've had a job that many people envy more as play than work. And I don't deny that most of the time what I do is fun. Most of the time I'm happily engaged in recording history, or at least facilitating its recording by filling out yet another form, juggling the budget, and generally keeping the shop in business and on the good side of the powers that be. But what I do, and what you do, is more than fun. Through a career in archives, each of us has preserved history. I recognize that in speaking of history, there are some among us who will take issue with me. They draw a line between history and archives, between manuscripts and records. They would say archivists document transactions. Archivists preserve records needed for administrative purposes. Archivists preserve material for reasons of legal and physical accountability. In fact, some will tell me that history, in the classic sense of that word, is not the primary objective of archivists, perhaps not even the secondary objective. While I respect and I honor the importance of preserving records to document transactions, to serve administrative needs, and to establish accountability, these are all parts of our professional mission. I respectfully submit that at the end, those activities are not the ultimate purpose that explains what archivists do. The need to document transactions slowly fades. Eventually, no one cares. Administrators and administrations move on. Eventually, the past is so far removed that there is no administrative need to remember how they did it or even why they did it. Eventually, even if eventually is a period of decades, or in some cases, centuries, accounts are settled and legal documentation loses all purpose. The Soviet Union is gone. Pre-revolutionary France has no standing in a court, and the resolutions passed on by the ancient Athenians no longer serve as the law within the Acropolis. What's left is history. It's the history of the Soviet Union, of Royal France, of the Athenian democracy, and so many other things from which we as a people collectively learn and through which we as a people collectively continue to grow. It is a past we explore not because we need it for some immediate practical reason, but rather because we require it. We require it for a broader, more meaningful purpose. It explains who we are. It explains why we are. It opens a window to our individual and collective soul. Archives are and will remain that place where, above everything else, the soul of a person and of a community is both preserved and laid bare. Insofar as humans can find truth, truth is in our holdings. Insofar as humans can find immortality, immortality is in our stacks. Because of this, this fundamental essence of humanity that resides within our repositories, those of us who work in archives are both privileged and significant. We are the selectors and the keepers of individual and collective memory. What archivists remember will be remembered, and conversely, what archivists forget will be forgotten. Appraisal is the key to all of our endeavors. It is the professional tool that defines remembrance and forgetfulness. Selection sets the stage for everything else archivists do. And for this reason, the discourse over selection is not an arcane academic exercise with no impact on the real world. Quite the contrary, it has every impact on the real world and how the real world will be understood and interpreted. What archivists select assuredly establishes accountability, creates administrative continuity, and satisfies legal need. But when all else falls to dust, archives are the remembrance that will ennoble lives today and lives to be born tomorrow. Because of the profound importance of appraisal within the broader society, I'm saddened and often pained that so many archivists seem to avoid selection or seek to limit it through narrowly construed criteria. I understand. Appraisal is difficult. It's challenging. And even under the best of circumstances, it's often problematic. Mistakes, sometimes irreversible mistakes, will be made. Knowing that, and knowing the justifiable concerns and fears this can generate among archivists, nevertheless, if not us, if not archivists, then who will make those choices for society? A clerk emptying out an old filing room, more interested in tonight's baseball game and the records passing before her? A computer technician purging files whose selection criteria are size of file, age of file, and number of recent uses? A distant cousin emptying out a child's bedroom, concerned more that he might miss the flight he booked than miss papers that tell the story of a beloved son? Destruction is the Faustian bargain archivists make when they take on responsibility for selection. But one way or another, the devil will get his. Society will forget. And the archival responsibility is to make the best of the deal. The archival responsibility is to do all in our power to mock the devil by ensuring remembrance. And we can mock the devil. We can cheat death. I commend all of us to take heart, to hold to the vision that we and we alone are granted through our education and our experience, and to employ that vision to shape a documentary universe and make it the best possible record we can construct for our successors. As I have already acknowledged, I know it will not be perfect. I know whatever we do, someone in the future will find flaws with our decisions. But I also know that if you accept the challenge of selection, if you face the fear of having to say yes, or worse, having to say no, you will do society the noble service our profession educates us to do, calls on us to perform, and which you, and you alone, can do better than anyone else within your organization and within your community, if you choose to do it. Like appraisal, arrangement and description is vital. The act of selecting is essential, but to select without making the resulting documentation available is to harvest fruit, but to forego its sweetness. It makes no sense. I don't pretend to understand arrangement and description as I do appraisal. Indeed, as someone lacking a library school degree, I sometimes find myself embarrassed by not fully comprehending the sea of acronyms that today flow through archival description. Creating a finding aid in EAD and linking it to an appropriate MARC record is, quite frankly, beyond my skills. But I know this, that unarranged, undescribed records might as well have been left in the trash beside the road. I know that while a detailed list is helpful, a broader description is critical. If librarians or gardeners carefully tending the individual plantings of various authors, we're foresters watching over vast stands of intellectual timber. We must use techniques and tools, rules, protocols, and best practices that make it possible to see and care for the entirety of our forest of documentation while not becoming lost among the individual trees. And I know this as well, that I'm often saddened as I read the literature about description and increasingly see it dominated by technical concerns and vocabulary issues. I know it's important to define terms carefully. I know it's important to get the semicolons in the right place. But I too often feel that the definitions and the punctuations have become ends in themselves rather than means to an end. Formulaic precision in place of a generous descriptive vision. I appreciate the challenges that incorporating this broad vision into systematic description can create for those who have to do the task. Rules, protocols, and best practices call for precision, but precision often is interpreted through practices focused largely on methodology. Constructing archival description is hard. Librarians may never accept what archivists do as really good enough. Records managers may consider what archivists do is really a waste of resources. But archivists know how we arrange and describe is neither. Archivists know that the archival description creates a unique bridge, sometimes narrow and tenuous, often less than perfectly engineered, and in all honesty, probably a little more rickety than we'd like to admit. But for all the shortcomings, a bridge always helping the user move from what they know to what they want to learn. Building in such a manner, I know that archival description will inevitably err. Walking across our bridge, the researcher may miss a rare flower on the forest floor, and frankly, on occasion, misidentify an entire stand of trees. But knowing that, let we as archivists not adopt rules, protocols, and best descriptive practices designed to minimize potential criticism, but rather err in a way that privileges the greatest flow of information to those who seek it. Our goal is to make description work for the users, not necessarily to make it neat and tidy, above criticism, or anything else. It focuses on the users. I know it's a hard thing to do, but like appraisal, we need not live in fear of the consequences of errors we might make, but rather we should celebrate the breadth of vision we can give. I know the talent you collectively bring to description. I know the education regarding descriptive technique you collectively share. If we dare to use our talent and our education, our vision, and our practical savvy, I know archivists can create and implement useful descriptive systems that eliminate the curse of backlogs. In the end, we must do this, for we can not only preserve the soul of our society, we must guide those looking for that essence to the place where they'll find the knowledge they seek. You can do it if you choose. Documents and data in electronic formats offer many challenges very similar to those found in descriptive and arrangement. However, the situation is even more complicated in that the sea of acronyms is added an ever-changing technological base. Clearly, archivists are uncertain what to do with this new media, and clearly many of us, and I confess, including myself, tend to sit on the sidelines hoping that in some way good luck will solve all our problems. But if luck is that place where hard work and opportunity meet, we each need to do the work and be prepared for the opportunity when it presents itself. You've been told often enough from platforms such as this one that electronic records are the future path archivists must travel. I don't intend to offer yet another lecture on that well-visited subject, but rather to acknowledge what speakers who invoke this rhetoric often fail to fully admit. This is hard. This is challenging. This is a valley of darkness from which I and many of you would prefer to be delivered. We are, after all, not being asked to adjust to a few minor bureaucratic changes in procedure, but rather to make informed decisions on the impact of a radical shift in records and recording media on our entire profession, from practice to theory, and to do it in an incredibly short period of time, on the fly, while we attend to all the other things we already need to do. But as I've already said in different ways, I firmly believe in the ability of those who proudly call themselves archivists to change and to adapt. If we are to save history, if we are to save what binds generations, then despite the pain and the difficulty, mastering electronic records is a task we must take upon ourselves. Not because we want to, but because we need to do what must be done. Appraisal, description, technology, to this list of basic archival tasks, one can quickly add preservation. Obviously, one of the things we do through our professional knowledge is to buy time for records. Quite literally buy time, by paying for expensive preservation quality storage areas and similar tools. Increasingly, we buy time in other ways. For example, by investing in new technology that allows us to transform fragile items or old unstable media into new, easily distributed electronic surrogates. But my mind is sometimes troubled when I speak with archivists who forget that we're buying that time and performing those expensive transformations for a purpose. Preservation, as well as conservation, is not an end to be automatically applied to archival material, but a tool which should be used selectively to ensure that the most essential core of our collective memory is passed down to others. Archivists know that they cannot save every document ever created, but we seem to often forget that likewise, we cannot preserve in perpetuity every scrap of information that finds its way into the archives. Emotionally, we often have trouble accepting this fact. I understand. I sympathize. We want to cling to what is emotionally dear to us, and our collections are dear. But in the end, we must continue to make the kind of choices that begin with selection and for which we, and we alone, are educated. We must link resources to needs and make informed choices. We must, in Maynard Bridgeford's memorable phrase, let it rot. At least some of it, selecting those things most dear as our remembrances to be passed down to the next generation, or perhaps the next millennium. Much of the list of activities that I've used to organize my presentation today are old standbys. Appraisal, arrangement, description, and preservation are functions we routinely rattle off when called upon to explain what an archivist does. Often forgotten is the responsibility for advocacy, particularly political advocacy. People sometimes shy away from advocacy, perhaps because they view it as self-serving, perhaps in some way even demeaning. However, advocacy is not just about getting what we believe should be ours, hiring a lobbyist to get more federal dollars, although that would be a good idea, or passing privacy legislation that aids us in our work. The ultimate purpose of political advocacy is to create an environment that makes it possible for us to preserve history through appropriate tools. We advocate not out of some selfish motive, not because we'd like a few more dollars in the paycheck or a few laws allowing us to get rid of some forms, but because of the importance of the heritage that we preserve. As I've already said, what archivists remember is remembered. what archivists forget is forgotten. The core reason archivists advocate is to ensure we can carry forward our collective missions with sufficient resources and working within a positive and helpful legal framework. Advocacy isn't about us. It isn't about archivists. Advocacy is about archives. It's about history. It's about preserving, in Abraham Lincoln's phrase, the mystic cords of memory that bind us one to another. That word memory brings me to the closing thoughts of this speech. As I hope I've already clearly said, when we employ our professional skills, when we select, when we arrange, when we describe, when we conserve, when we advocate, we do these things not simply in pursuit of information linked to a clear functional need. What we accomplish is much greater. We cause to be remembered triumph and tragedy. We give voice to those who can no longer speak. We preserve memories for those who can no longer remember. Archivists weave a fragile veil of paper through which, however dimly, the present can see the past and the living can hear the dead. We archivists, we are nothing less than the stewards of humanity's legacy. Our stewardship is a privilege. Our stewardship is an honor. And our stewardship is an incredible burden. But when we perform our stewardship well, we give memory and continuity to the most important aspects of our society and the most important individuals in our lives. Sometimes by saving the records of institutions, often by preserving the stories of individuals. We accomplish this by exercising both diligence and breadth in our search for documentation. Remembrance is a peculiar thing, and its best sources are never consistent with looking with simple cookbooks of archival practice. What we seek may not be found in the official records of a president, but rather in the Facebook page of a high school student. To cope with this, ours is a profession that calls for deep learning and supple adjustment. We must know the ground well, but we also must be able to adjust quickly to the local weather. When we as archivists are at our best in carrying out our stewardship, when we mix successfully our book learning and our street savvy, we do indeed make a profound difference. But to be at our best, serving as an archivist is more than a job. Archives becomes a calling. And if you remember nothing else of what I've said, please try to remember simply this. For this is what archivists, I believe, most need to remember. Hear the calling. Hear it both in your head and in your heart. And choose to live it. Doing so gives archivists the vision and the power to define remembrance, to link present to past, and living to dead. Doing so is the highest goal to which we aspire. Doing so is truly within your power. Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.